Hey friends, it's Ashley. Before we get started, I just wanted to tell you about the Patreon, which I hate talking about, and I feel like I want to crawl into my sweater, even bringing it up, but it's an important way that this podcast stays alive. Through big and small donations from listeners, we're able to bring you interesting and relevant stories about the coffee world. You can donate anywhere from $1 a month to $25, and your donations are what keep this whole project going. We're going to be talking about the Patreon a little bit more in the coming weeks. So if you can, please consider donating by going to patreon.com/bossbarista. If you've benefited at all from this show, especially if you're in a position of power, I urge you to consider making a donation. Okay, now on to the show. Hey friends, this is Boss Barista. I'm Ashley Rodriguez. I studied sociology in college. Sociology is basically just a fun way to say that I studied why people do things. It's almost like you got a major in people watching. If I'm being perfectly honest, I thought I was going to be a biology major, but I couldn't hack chemistry, and then I kind of bounced around from major to major until I landed on sociology kind of by accident. And for a long time, I thought that I was taking an easy way out because this was easy for me. And then I realized that this was maybe the way that my brain worked, that I liked seeing patterns in the way that we think about things, that I noticed that there are structures that dictated why we thought about things the way that we do. And the biggest thing that I learned from studying sociology is that nothing is preordained. Everything in the world is based on complex social structures, but none of them mean anything, and none of them are necessarily good or bad. They're good or bad based on the meaning that we as humans assign them. This mode of thinking would sometimes get me in a rabbit hole of nihilist thinking. If nothing matters, then what's the point of anything, really? But it also helped me realize that we have an immense amount of control over the world around us. Not always, and not over everything, but if there's a system in place that we're unhappy with, we can work to dismantle it. There's nothing that says that this system has to be the one we use, especially if that system is broken. Dismantling existing systems is an interesting idea and something that the coffee world has been talking a lot about, especially in light of the coffee price crisis. So I decided to talk to a sociologist named Noah Berger to see what she thought about the structures and systems that we use to understand coffee. I met Noah at RICO, which is a lecture series that focuses on big problems in the coffee industry. And while I was traveling in Paris, I got a chance to learn more about her work and how she takes her sociological lens and applies it to the world of coffee.
My name is Noah Berger, and I am a PhD student. I study sociology at a university in France called EAGSS, the School of Advanced Studies in Social Sciences. And my research is focused on the specialty coffee market in France and Brazil, more specifically.
How did you get involved in coffee? Why did you want to study coffee through a sociological lens? I guess those are two different questions, but...
Yeah, I mean, from a sociological lens, I've studied sociology before. So I did my undergraduate in sociology and anthropology, then my MA in anthropology in France. So the coffee part was kind of complicated or complex. I wasn't honestly really into coffee. I never worked in the industry. I was never a barista. I just liked coffee shops mm-hmm. a lot. I spend all my time through my MA and BA as well, like working from coffee shops. And I did my master's degree on something very, very different. And I had to pick a new subject. And I looked for a while. And then I found this... I found this research program headed by a sociologist called Eva Illouz. And the research program was about the consumption of emotional experiences, like how emotions are commodified, how they become like goods for consumption, basically. And I don't know, and I just had this idea because I was spending so much time in coffee shops and I was a little bit interested in it throughout my MA as well. And I was like, well, like, that could be a good angle to study that theme. And I just started at first with the question of like the atmosphere of the coffee shop and the place itself. But as I got more and more into it and I met more people, I got the opportunity to go to Brazil as well and visit some farms there. And then I completely fell in love with coffee and everything around it, everything that happens around it, and then kind of widened the scope of my research from beyond just the coffee shop space to the whole value chain.
So what does your research look like right now?
So the question I have basically is, what happens when a specialty market, in this case coffee, arrives at a country where there's already an established tradition and established ideas around how to make and drink coffee, which is the case of Paris, the city of cafes, and Brazil, that's like the world's largest coffee producer and exporter. But in both countries, while they're known for a coffee culture, it's like commodity or not right. The best quality from the point of view of a specialty market. So then the specialized market arrives and says, like, you guys, you don't know what's quality. You don't know how to make and drink coffee. Let us teach you. So how then is the idea of quality negotiated and defined and redefined? How does the dialogue with the local traditions happen? So that is my question. And the way I study it is I'm engaging a sort of ethnography, which means I spend a lot of time in the field, hanging out with coffee people, attending events, interviewing. And I interview actors all across the chain. So starting with producers, and then going through exporters and importers and roasters, coffee shop owners, baristas, designers, customers, and trying to see like how every actor kind of endows coffee with an aesthetic, symbolic values or meaning, how quality is constructed through that process.
Those are such big questions that I think that we're maybe starting to poke at in the coffee industry. Like, you hear people talk about emotional labor a lot. And I think that like that kind of starts to scratch the surface of a little bit of what your research is. So how can baristas kind of start to understand your work in like terms of like their everyday lives?
Well, it's true that these are huge questions, and what's interesting about these questions is that they do touch
pretty much
the daily work and everybody across along the chain. So it can be for coffee shop owners, for example. It can be design choices. Right now I'm thinking a lot about this. I don't have much to say about the producing side as well, because I still have a lot of work to do. But on the consuming side in France, so it starts from like the design of the coffee shop as well, and also for example, what kind of messages do we convey with the way we shape our spaces? Do we try to connect to like tradition and do coffee shops that kind of are reminiscent of the Parisian cafe, thus maybe opening our spaces up to larger populations? Do we go along with this kind of more Anglo-Saxon design that kind of signals to clients that they've got something different here, something revolutionary, something new, but then also has a very precise, definite idea of how the future innovation revolution looks like, which may be more like Anglo. So it's these kind of things. It's also what you were saying about emotional labor as well. What kind of a service experience are we providing to our clients? In the French case, there are a lot of people talking about like French service, but it's not the same thing. The bistrot, the like classical French kind of more down to earth kind of French service, or the high end kind of service that brings the client to you instead of you going to him. There are so many different questions that participate in the construction of of quality that we have to deal with every day.
So how have you seen the coffee scene change in France? Because you said you were here for 6 years, so you've probably seen a lot of really big things happen. And every time I talk to somebody who has worked in coffee in France for a little bit, they tell me that the last like 8 or 9 years have been huge in the terms of the growth of the specialty movement, but it is still very complicated.
Yeah, definitely. So I've only been doing my research for almost 2 years now, but I did do a mini research project when I was just as I arrived to France and I started my studies in 2013. I went to interview some people at Coutume to try and see, talk about this institutionalizing movement. So it's true that I do have some very short-sighted historical perspective. And as everyone says, I mean, it's growing very quickly. You could say booming, like now there are roasteries opening every month. But what is interesting, I think, is the idea that there is like a sort of diversification. I think it's problematic to even talk about, like, in a way, about French specialty coffee, because there are so many different ways to what it can be or what it is. So there are those that are choosing to go more and more towards the customer, towards tradition, for example, that are going more for blends, that are doing capsules, kind of connecting more to what already exists. I don't know, buying out bistros and making them into specialty coffee shops. That are then there are those that are doing like the kind of high-end fine dining French thing. They're taking it to an extreme, and they're also managing to get to, you know, a larger crowd, but through the luxury, because it's a luxury everyone can afford. Then there are those like still sticking to the more kind of Anglo approach, and, you know, more like a filter coffee, no milk, no sugar, very clean spaces, and, you know, they're very. That's I think what is the most beautiful thing, is that when something gets like a hold, then you can see diversification, and not everyone's doing the same thing. You just have very different approaches. I don't think there are better ones, you know. I just think that there are, that each direction or each choice is kind of entrenched in a context and has, right, maybe consequences. But I, as a sociologist, like, I don't make value judgments.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I'm thinking of something that you mentioned to me a couple of nights ago about specialty coffee kind of borrowing from both a scientific perspective and an artisan perspective. I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think that's something, again, at this point, it's just a hypothesis because I haven't finished doing my interviews, but it's things that I started noticing. I think traditionally, when we say authenticity, okay, when we say authenticity in coffee or authenticity anywhere, we tend to have this image of this kind of narrativizing, exoticizing, very emotional kind of way of presenting something, right? Like authentic coffee. It's not even a word we use so much anymore in coffee. I feel like you think about like pictures of like producers' hands holding red cherries, you know? Mm. And I think that's, again, there is a diversification in how the authenticity or the origins of coffee are being represented. I think what happened, it's just a theory that I have. What always happens in capitalism is that big companies, the big actors, like in the case of coffee, it'll be Starbucks and the likes, they look at what's happening in the specialty markets, and they pick up these ideas and they kind of integrate them in their own communications and their own practices. And then you have Starbucks that are doing their Starbucks Reserve projects, et cetera, right? Artisanal roasteries. And they also pick up all these ways of describing a product as authentic, and they pick up all these semantics. So when you go on their Instagram, like the Starbucks Reserve, you see like how they portray the barista as an artist, and they talk about craft, and they talk about origins, and all these things that you already see in the specialty market. And I wonder maybe if, as a response to that, the specialty coffee market is stirring away, is becoming more conscious also of this kind of discourse, or more weary of it, and is kind of trying to find maybe new ways of talking about coffee that are just different. So then you start seeing talk more about the science of coffee, like the projects around transparency, which, again, the transparency projects, I'm not trying to say that it's just like a marketing tool, not at all. I think that obviously transparency, first of all, and there is a real concern, which is, in order to pay producers better, we have to understand how much they're actually getting, right? So transparency and traceability helps us understand, right, that it actually assure like a sustainable coffee production, first of all. But other than that, it's also leveraged, I think. And that's not a bad thing. It's also leveraged to maybe think differently about coffee. Coffee is authentic, not just because it's like this kind of emotionalized, narrativized product that evokes emotions in us or stories or narratives. It's also authentic because it can be authentified, because we can trace down its origins, because we can have full transparency on the way it's made, on the way it's procured, on the way it's consumed, because it's entrenched in research and in science. And I think that's really interesting because it's really different from the way we're used to think about these kind of concepts.
Yeah, you're totally right. I didn't even think of the idea that like you can shift almost the meaning of authenticity kind of depending on context. Like at one point, authenticity, I think in the specialty coffee market, especially when I started in like 2010, would have been like artisan craftsmanship and like only I can make something a certain way. And now authenticity is like, how far can we go down the transparency chain to say, who made this coffee? How much are we paying for it? And that becomes an authentic experience. It's interesting that that's a moving target.
Right, it is. And the thing is, you make reference to these kind of things a lot in your podcast. That's what I like about what you do because you have a very sociological perspective. And I think every term that we take, every cultural notion like authenticity or local or moral or ethical or whatever is so context dependent and is very liquid. So even this move towards like authenticity as authentication, as transparency, coexists alongside these portrayals of more craft, the art world as well. And I think this kind of narrativization and emotionalization persists as well, which again is not a bad thing. But for example, what I also noticed is that so I analyzed social media posts of Starbucks, and then I went back to the specialty coffee social media, and I noticed this kind of more science-driven discourse. But then I also realized that from what I've been observing in like cuppings and competitions and interactions with clients, I feel like it's still much more about the emotional experience that the client goes through. And I'm wondering, then I was thinking, I mean, it's just that also in different places or different contexts, authenticity means different things or is constructed in a different way. So in the coffee shop space or in cuppings, it'll be not so much about transparency, but still more about this narrativized thing. The person who hosts the cupping will frequently mention like how the first coffee they tried, like the emotional experience that it had them go through. And I think that's probably partially because it's a service industry that requires emotional labor and has codes of hospitality. And all of that kind of demands and requires a certain degree of narrativization to get the client in. You know what I mean? While on social media, you become very aware also of what you post. You can reread yourself. So you're not going to have this kind of, cementology.
That's so interesting because I was thinking what that reminded me of was like, almost when if you're a wholesale roaster, for example, and you have to connect with the customer, how do you make that relationship? And where is value created in that situation? Like, why is this roaster better than this one? Why is this one better than that one? And the way that people make decisions about who they stick with too, like I'll always go to this coffee shop because this is the one that I love. But it's like, does that relationship really mean anything? I don't know.
Well, I mean, you have to get the like a customer comes to your coffee shop, or even he's outside of your coffee shop, how will he know, how will he even have the opportunity to learn about the product if you don't bring him in through service and through design and through talking about his emotions? So I don't think it's like a bad thing or that it, you know, brings it down in any way to like have this kind of discourse. You just need to be aware of it. But then, yeah, I mean, telling the client that the coffee has an amazing taste and it might evoke memories for him or her is a way to bring the client to you, because you can't, I mean, I don't run a coffee shop, so I don't know, but I imagine it's difficult, you know, for baristas to start talking to their clients immediately about transparency before they've even tasted the coffee,
right,
and got something out of it that's beyond the taste, because they're looking for something that's beyond just the taste when they're coming to a specialty coffee shop. So all these things like the design, the emotions, the hospitality, the emotional labor, the service part of it are ways to, you know, bring the client in, and then hopefully he'll want to learn more right. about how the product is procured, but you can't force it upon him.
Yeah, know? That totally makes sense. Something that I think is interesting, and I wonder what you think of this, is so immediately what I think about when we talk about how we bring customers in, and maybe I'm digging myself a little bit in a hole here, is there's this coffee shop in New York that I used to love going to just to observe. It's called Abrasso. And people love Abrasso. They absolutely love it. Like, you'll see people just pouring out on the street. And even when I was here, someone was like, oh, have you ever been to Abrasso? Because I lived in New York for a long time. That being said, I hated getting coffee there. I loved being there.
Why?
Because they pull very like ristretto type, like Italian. It's a very Italian style coffee shop. Mm. So everything that I'm taught about specialty coffee goes against the way that they served coffee. And not to say it was bad. Again, I'm shooting myself in the foot here, maybe on air. But to me, I was taught that like you're supposed to, you know, pull coffee for balance and things like that. So I would see these experiences with customers where they swear by this coffee shop, but it's like the opposite of everything that you're taught as a barista. So I wonder how you reconcile those things. Because to me, all it says is that like, you know, taste is subjective, totally nothing matters. That's what that says to me.
Yeah, I mean, you don't need to reconcile this. The fact is that we live in a consumption scape that's extremely diversified, where people just consume all the time. And food products especially. I mean, it's not, you can't have enough of them, right? It's not like an object that you buy and stays at your home. So there's like, in this sense, there's place and space for a lot. So the coffee shop you're mentioning probably did a good job at understanding their target audience and what they're looking for. But this doesn't cater to the people who maybe will be looking for a different experience from the specialty coffee. For me as a sociologist, again, I'm very much engaged in this community and industry, but I come from a point of view that tries to look things with no personal judgment and say, well, you know, there are those who make Italian style coffee and those who make like a specialty style coffee. And the definition of what specialty coffee is, the margins can be a little bit vague sometimes. I was giving a talk this Saturday at the coffee festival. And in the end, someone asked me a question about whether I think that specialty coffee can like go outside, like reach outside of Paris, reach outside of the big cities, because people often like to say that it's true that it's a very kind of cosmopolitan, urban experience. You know, it's an urban phenomenon. But then I was also thinking that, I mean, sure, this on the one hand, it's very related to middle upper classes that live in cities, highly educated, cosmopolitan, etc. But then It also depends on how we define specialty coffee, right? Because there are a lot of people in cities outside of France that roast coffee and roast coffee in a more or less crafty way, not even an industrial scale. Maybe even source their coffee in a way that we would consider ethical or through specialty coffee importers. But we discard them. We don't consider them to be specialty, maybe because of the way their coffee shops look, or maybe because they're roasted a tad darker than what we would prefer. So our perspective changes the reality in that sense as well. What, you know.
Right. So you were at Rico at the same time I was.
Yeah, I was.
And the talks kind of centered around this idea of the coffee price crisis. And something that stood out to me that I wanted to talk to about more was the idea of value and how value is also created, and also who adds value to a thing.
Right.
Because I think that was kind of an underlying theme of Rico that no one was quite touching upon, the idea that value is created. So I was wondering if you could talk about that and how, as a sociologist, you see, you know, we pay maybe $2.50 for a pound of coffee, but then you see that same coffee sold for $16, $17 a pound, and how we reconcile who adds value to a thing.
Well, I would be still very cautious about talking about the production side of things.
Right.
Because I did spend about 5 weeks in Brazil without really speaking Portuguese. spend most of my time in one farm. So I'm very cautious in everything that concerns like, you know, production dynamics, because I just don't want to say nonsense. There are people that know this better than myself. However, I could just evoke the idea of, you know, that there is more than one type of value, obviously, more than just financial value. And financial value is very much just extracted from and dependent on different kind of values that we attribute to products and that justify their price. Saying who adds more value, again, I don't think there is like an objective response to that. Is the work of the farmer more valuable or should be, you know, than the work of the roaster, than the work of the barista? I do have a few comments, though, or things that I can evoke. For example, what I noticed, I also just thought about this weekend, and it's just an hypothesis, but if I'm not mistaken, and please someone correct me if I'm wrong, the two sides of the chain, the two ends of the chain, who probably make the smallest margins or that, you know, are underpaid, in a certain way, are the producers and the baristas, right? But these are the ones that also have the most romanticization around their work, right? And it's like the barista is portrayed as this kind of like artist, craftsman. There are all these competitions. There are all these opportunities to express, to compete. And the producer as well. I mean, there are a lot of narratives about exoticization of their work and like also like a kind of romantic portrayal of poverty in some cases, not always, of course. And I mean, that's exactly like examples of how different types of value that are not economical are used to justify maybe lesser economic returns, right? So you mobilize like the value of the pride, of the legitimacy of your work, of the craftsmanship of your work, to make it worthwhile to not get paid properly. And I don't think there's like anyone, it's not like, you know, it's not like a Marxist vision where there's like a group of evil, like whatever, importers or exporters or coffee shop owners that are like, let's make them believe they're doing something crafty so we can pay them less. No, of course not. That's not at all how it works. It does not work on the individual level. It's more of societal dynamics that are very hard to deconstruct and unpack. But, you know, again, it starts from being aware.
Right. And I think one thing that was really kind of hopeful about Rico, maybe not everything was hopeful, a lot of it was kind of a bummer, was the idea that we were talking about colonialism in a way that I don't think that the specialty coffee market has done so publicly so often, and how the system of the supply system is kind of designed to work exactly how it was intended to work.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that we extract labor from colonized places,
right,
for the benefit of consuming countries.
Right.
So I wonder, like, what takeaways did you have from Rico as a sociologist, or even just in general? Like, when you look at a problem in coffee, how do you kind of apply your sociological lens to say, like, how do I ask questions about this or how do I learn more about this?
Well, actually, there were a few talks around these issues that I found really interesting and thought-provoking. So there was another anthropologist that was there called Edward Fisher. And he presented his research about coffee production in Guatemala and coffee consumption. I think he was studying the United States. And he made a very interesting point. He showed that while the specialty coffee market does kind of balance out more, you know, the we call it in sociology the control over the means of production. That means that in Guatemala specifically, for example, the arrival of the specialty coffee market or the demand for specialty coffee transferred a lot of the power to small-scale producers of the Maya ethnicity, so that were previously not having like much of a, you know, they weren't really able to compete in that production sphere. But when specialty coffee started valuing like coffees grown in small scale farms in high elevations, like they got their chance and they obtained like control over farms, over their means of production. But what he shows is that this is not the only thing that matters. There's also control over the symbolic means of production. And what's happening in specialty coffee to be aware of is that it's still a market, even though it's definitely more ethical than what happens in the sea market, that fluctuates around taste. And tastes that change very quickly. And it's the tastes of the consumers, I have the impression, and again, please, if I'm wrong, correct me, send me an email or something, that it's the consumer tastes that determine for many producers what they will grow and the kind of processing methods that they will use. So when there's a wave of preference for natural coffees, then a lot of producers will find themselves like in need to you know, kind of move to that. And it wouldn't be like in markets like wine, where you wouldn't even imagine going to a wine producer and telling him, this is how I want my wine. please like process your wine the way I want it now, because it tastes better, because it's cleaner, because whatever. Of course, every market reacts to consumer trends and to consumer demands. But I think that it's more so in the case of coffee and other ex-colonial commodities. Same with the price, obviously. I mean, the prices are fixed not by the producers, but by you know, the buyers. So just something that I left with Rico is the understanding of the control over the symbolic means of production is still very, very much in the consuming side, you know, consuming end, and that has real impacts on lives and you know, in the producing end of the scale. Something to be aware of.
What are some of the questions that you have that you'd like more researchers to answer? Because I imagine being a sociologist in the field of coffee, there's not that many people doing the work that you're doing. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, like, where do you seek out information and what do you hope people will tackle in the future?
Well, honestly, what's surprising is that I keep discovering all these people working on coffee that I didn't know were doing it much more than I thought. So there was Sabine that you interviewed a couple of months ago, who's doing amazing work on Brazil. So she talked about her research about women in coffee competitions, but she's actually working on the Brazilian market. And it's funny because the academia has so many problems. And one of them is like it's extremely hard to meet other researchers that work on what you work on, especially in my case where my advisor doesn't work on coffee. There's no one in my school that works on coffee. So I thought I was alone. And what happened was that after a year or so of doing my research alone in my little, you know, apartment, because we don't even have like a fucking library, sorry. I can say fucking great because I say it a lot. Anyway, so I was alone in my apartment, and then I decided, well, I'm tired of this. I'm gonna go out there and I'm gonna start attending like events, and I'm gonna start talking in events as well. And in the industry events, in the specialty coffee events, I started meeting other researchers, not at all through academia. So yeah, so I've just been meeting amazing historians, sociologists, anthropologists, sensorial scientists that are doing splendid work. People in business schools as well, tackling coffee from all kinds of different angles. So it's hard to say. I hope, obviously, that what I'm doing needs to be done. Otherwise, there's no point in me doing it. Yeah, but I feel like in the questions around transparency and traceability, there's a lot to do because it's pretty new. It's pretty emerging. Yeah, everything that's the price crisis, there is a lot of stuff to be done, but I feel like there are people working on this. There is another amazing project two really interesting projects that I've learned about in Rico. One is the Transparent Transaction Guide that's driven by a professor from Emory University and a bunch of roasters and importers that are trying to basically constitute an index for how much roasters and buyers are like paying for their coffee, you know, to have a reference. And there is also a huge project called Enveritas with an E that's funded like by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And they're using like satellite technology.
I haven't heard of this one.
Oh yeah. The CEO was at RICO talking about it. It's a really impressive project. Again, I don't know the details enough. Like I'm not endorsing, you know, these works, but they're interesting. They're trying to do something or to map out at least. Then what you do with it is a different question. So they're using satellite technology to kind of map out all the coffee farms in the world, to try their declared goal is to end poverty in the coffee production by 2050, I think. And they're sending out apparently guys on motorcycles as well to like conduct interviews. I'm not sure what they're actually going to do with this data and how they're going to end poverty through it, but the fact that they're trying to map out and get data already is very interesting and is very lacking. On a large scale.
It's so I loved meeting you because I studied sociology when I was in college. And I've never really pursued it. But something that you said to me maybe 2 days ago or something like that, was that you appreciated that I approached things from a sociological perspective. And I honestly had to sit and think about that. And I was like, I don't know. Like how? Like I was very confused, but I was not confused, but I was like, mostly because like I thought about like my sociology degree is like totally useless. So I'm interested to know like how like others can kind of approach things sociologically. Cause I think like this is mostly an audience of baristas. So like how can they start to kind of question the world around them?
Right. So I think, first of all, totally still think that, I mean, I totally stand by this declaration. I think you have a very sociological and very critical perspective that this is what I like about what you do. And for me, being a sociologist means three different things. So there's being a sociologist in the sense of the diploma. You know, I can call myself a sociologist if I have a PhD in sociology, so I can't really call myself a sociologist yet. There's sociology in terms of the knowledge and the traditions that I kind of hearken back to. But for me, truly, being a sociologist is a perspective that, or kind of a prism that you look at the world from. And there are many people that have PhDs in sociology that I know that I don't consider to truly be sociologists. And I have many friends who I consider as sociologists, but have never studied it at all in their life. And for me, it's about perspective, context, relativity. It's about the fact that you think or believe or accept that everything is socially constructed. Everything, including things that we're used to think about is almost like biological, things related to how we think or feel our body. Even I think a really good example is blushing, right? So blushing is a physical, completely physical reaction, but it's induced by something completely related to norms, right? Gag reflexes at certain things that are not just a horrible smell. Even the odors that make us like cringe are very culturally constructed. There's research to show, really interesting research about encounters between groups of different women from different cultures where they both found each other's like odors like disgusting because one group was wearing perfume and, you know, really, really so many examples. But in any case, for me, it's really about understanding that there's nothing intrinsically right, wrong, good or bad. And it doesn't mean that we can't make value judgments. Like I choose my morals and my ideas and my consumption practices and, you know, my relationship practices. But for me, it's accepting that it's a choice. It's not like morally it's wrong to, for example, cheat or lie. It's not like objectively wrong. It's just that we live in a society where we decided together unofficially or kind of came up with a bunch of norms and rules that we live by. And you can accept to live by those rules and respect other people, but everything can be deconstructed. And I think when you truly accept this perspective, the sociological perspective, then you learn to be more open to other people's perspectives and choices. So it's like, you know, you can still believe or think or stand by like the coffee that you're making. Like for me, I'm making the best coffee that I can, but it doesn't mean that what someone else is doing, their choices in design or roasting profiles or the audience that they're targeting it doesn't mean that it's like it's bad or wrong. It's just it subscribes in a different context and it has different consequences. And you get to like or not like certain things. So yeah, for me, it's really the idea of perspective and kind of a liquidity of things. Yeah.
No, and that's super helpful because I think for so long in coffee, we kind of treated quality as a fixed target. We treated quality as this is either good or it's not good. And we hear people kind of talk about coffee in that manner that like people are going to come here because the coffee is good or, you know, like the quality will stand for itself. And that's not to say that people are doing a bad job or anything like that, but it's the idea that like quality is a social construct as well.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's a social construct. It doesn't mean that I'm not saying like we should drop all criteria and live in a liquid world where everything is the same and nothing matters. There are scientific indications to measure, you know, a certain level of acidity in coffee, a certain level of sweetness. But the fact that we decide that this level of acidity and this level of sweetness now is better, that's where the social construction comes in. And again, it's completely normal. I mean, otherwise we would be living in the world with just too many stimulations. We would have to make decisions every minute of our lives. So it makes sense to construct hierarchies and divisions and, you know, and have values and preferences, including like collective preferences for certain tastes. I mean, there are tastes that are more complex chemically, but at certain points of time or in certain industries we value complexity, but while in others we value simplicity, you know? So complexity, for example, is not always better. It depends.
Can people read your work somewhere?
So what I'm doing actually is a way to advance my PhD. I'm putting stuff out there, not only academic. The things I'm putting out right now, I would say, are not my research results, because I can't do that until I finished my research and analyzed everything. They're more drawing from the work done by many others, historians, for example, about the history of French coffee, and from that, asking questions. So that's what I'm doing right now, and I just had two articles come out, my first for coffee journals, one in Standard Magazine in the latest issue, I think it's issue number 9, the
it's
orange
right here,
one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's right here.
This is issue number 15.
Is it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
Sorry, guys, it's Standard. yeah, so I did their Paris map, and I included in it like a historical review of coffee in France, from which I again go to a number of questions about where specialty coffee is going in France. And I did something a little bit similar for 25 magazine, the Specialty Coffee Association magazine, around questions of aesthetics and how we represent specialty coffee innovation. How do we kind of reconcile like highlighting the origins of coffee while also like dialoguing with the local crowd and local culture as well. So yeah, I had these two. I have another one, I think, coming out in the next Standard about milk that I'm really looking forward
to. Ooh, that's
exciting. Yeah. And then, so I love Standard. If they take my stuff, I'm going to continue publishing there as long as they let me. And I might have something coming up at between academia and business. Like I think I have something coming up in the Harvard Business Review, so you're welcome to get in touch.
I love the Harvard Business
Review. Yeah, they're really
Review.
Cool. I think they're awesome. Like I like things that are at the frontier between.
Every time I tell people to read something about management or about leadership, I'm like, just subscribe to the Harvard Business Review.
It's awesome. I mean, I'm honestly surprised. I just discovered recently the world of business schools. I was kind of weary as a sociologist, but they're interesting things.
They're so interesting the way that they think about, I think they think about problems in a way that having a sociology background, I would think about problems too.
Right.
Which I would have never expected.
But more hands-on.
Yeah, exactly. You know? But more practical, and then someone wants to give you a lot of money when you're done.
Exactly. Well, so yeah, I'm not against it.
Yeah. Well, thanks for being on the show with us.
Thank
if people want to get in touch
me.
With you, how could they do that?
You're more than welcome to follow me on Instagram. My Instagram is Noah_Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R. You can also write me an email. Should I say my email here?
Yeah, if you'd like to.
Yeah, sure. It's Noale noelle.berger, B-E-R-G-E-R, at gmail.com. You're more than welcome to write to me with questions. Tell me I've been saying nonsense if I have.
That's not going to happen.
I don't know. You never know.
Well, no, I think this has been... This is a perspective that I think a lot of baristas rarely get to hear because we're, you know, entrenched in the coffee shops every day. So it's, I think it's important to kind of step back and think about bigger questions and also empower people to ask those bigger questions on the floor, which I think they can. So
thank you. I appreciate you saying that. I just want to, you know, I also publish these articles, except for just like self-gratification, because I really want to give something back. Like, there are all these amazing people sharing from their time, you know, with me, answering my questions, being patient with me, teaching me stuff, letting me in. And I want to, you know, share back from my observations. And if it helps someone ask more questions, then wonderful, you know.
Thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Boss Barista is made by me, Ashley Rodriguez, in collaboration with Good Beer Hunting, which is an industry-leading design studio, editorial platform, and podcast examining all the ways we look at the things that we eat and drink. You can check out more at goodbeerhunting.com. Seriously, their stories are incredible. My favorite series right now is the Humanity and Hospitality series that they've been running for the past couple of months, examining different ways that we look at people in the service industry. Special thanks to Jesse Raub and Jordan Stalling. Also, special thanks to our music contributors, the band Lost in the Sun. You've made this podcast sound incredible. I'm just looking for a band.